The Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're digging into a topic that, well, let's be honest, can sometimes feel a bit academic. The chemical elements.
Yeah, the periodic table.
Yeah.
It might bring back some less than thrilling memories of high school chemistry for some folks.
Exactly. But we promise you this is so much more interesting than just memorizing symbols. We're going way beyond that today.
We're using Philip Ball's fantastic book, The Elements, a very short introduction as our guide. If you think the periodic table is just some dusty chart in a classroom wall, well, Ball has a great line. He calls it science's greatest map. Not of some distant land, but of matter itself.
Ooh, I like that. A map of matter itself. That's the core idea, isn't it? It's not just a list, it's a story.
Yeah.
So our mission in this deep dive is basically to shift how you think about the fundamental stuff that makes up everything. We want to unpack this idea that the elements connect absolutely everything in the universe. Their story gives us this incredible lens to look at, well, cosmic history, how science even developed, and honestly, our own place in it all.
Yeah, we're going on quite a journey from like ancient ideas about the world, right up to modern particle accelerators. It's the story of matter itself.
Okay, so let's get into it. Before we trace that history, let's talk about our guide, Philip Ball. What makes him the right person to take us on this grand tour, as you called it?
Well, Ball is really perfectly suited for this. He's a very well-respected British science writer. He actually has a PhD in physics.
Ah, okay.
And importantly, he spent years as an editor at Nature, the science journal.
Right, so he's seen the cutting edge across different fields.
Exactly. He's not just stuck in one silo like chemistry or physics.
Yeah.
He understands the big picture.
And our sources called him a scientific humanist. What does that mean in practice? How does it shape his writing?
It means he bridges the gap. He has this amazing ability to connect the dots between chemistry, physics, astronomy, history, even philosophy. He doesn't just give you the facts, you know, the what. He digs into the why and the how, the human stories behind the discoveries.
So he turns technical stuff into actual narratives.
Precisely. He makes the science accessible and, honestly, compelling. He takes the periodic table from being just data to being this chronicle of human curiosity, mistakes, breakthroughs, the whole messy, brilliant process.
Making the invisible visible, as you said earlier, that feels like the heart of the book. It's trying to connect the abstract idea of an element to the, you know, chair you're sitting on or the air you're breathing.
Absolutely. Ball tackles a really fundamental question. How did these basic building blocks even come to be? And how do they combine to create literally everything we see? Diamonds, DNA, stars, us.
It's a massive scope.
It is, but the great thing is he doesn't assume you're already a scientist. He wrote it for a general audience.
So it really is a grand tour, starts with cosmic origins and stars, goes through history, and ends up at the edge of modern science, like creating new elements in labs.
Yeah, it shows how matter organizes itself, and critically, how we humans slowly, painstakingly figured out the rules of that organization. It's a story of discovery.
Okay, so to really appreciate the modern periodic table, that map of matter, we need to go back. We need to understand how the very idea of an element changed over time, because it wasn't always protons and neutrons.
Not at all. The definition has shifted dramatically.
Yeah.
And the history there is fascinating. It took a surprisingly long time to get past the first stage.
Which was ancient Greece, right? The classic element.
Exactly. Thinkers like Aristotle, Empedocles, they talked about earth, air, fire, and water. Sometimes the fifth one, ether, for the heavens.
But these weren't elements like we think of them now, were they? Fire wasn't like a substance.
Right. It was more like the principle of hotness or dryness. Air was wetness and hotness. It was about qualities, abstract principles.
And this was based on logic, not experiments.
Purely logic and observation of qualities, not measurement, not breaking things down. And because it was such a, well, logically neat system, it completely dominated Western thought for something like 2,000 years.
2,000 years. Wow. So what finally broke that hold? How did we start moving towards, you know, actual lab work?
Alchemy. That was the crucial, messy, but vital transition phase.
The guys trying to turn lead into gold.
Them, exactly. Now, they were still pretty mystical, definitely focused on transmutation. But their work shifted the focus. They started thinking less about abstract dryness and more about observable chemical properties.
Like Paracelsus, he had his own set of principles, didn't he?
He did. He talked about salt representing solidity, sulfur representing flammability or combustibility, and mercury representing fluidity or metallicity.
So still principles, but closer to actual chemical behavior.
Getting closer, yeah. And maybe even more importantly, all their endless experimenting trying to make gold, find the elixir of life, it forced them to develop practical lab techniques. Things like distillation, crystallization, careful heating, methods we still use the foundations of today. They built the toolkit, even if their theory was off.
Okay, so alchemy provides the tools and a shift towards properties. But it's still not quite modern chemistry. What was the next big leap? What brought in the rigor?
That had to be the chemical revolution, primarily with Antoine Lavoisier in the late 18th century. He's often called the father of modern chemistry for a reason. Lavoisier gave us the first really operational definition of an element.
Operational meaning?
Meaning based on what you can do in the lab.
Mm-hmm.
He defined an element as a substance that cannot be broken down into simpler substances by any known chemical means.
So it's defined by its resistance to decomposition.
Exactly. And crucially, this was all based on rigorous quantitative measurement. Weighing things carefully before and after reactions. It was true experimental evidence, finally overthrowing those two millennia of philosophical ideas.
That transition speed is just incredible when you think about it. Thousands of years of one idea, then boom, a revolution based on measurement.
It really is.
But you mentioned even Lavoisier's definition wasn't the final story. It was powerful, but incomplete. What was missing?
Well, Lavoisier's definition was essentially practical. It told you what an element wasn't. It wasn't breakable by chemistry. But by the mid-19th century, chemists had found dozens of these unbreakable substances.
Okay.
They had a list of ingredients, you could say.
Yeah.
But they didn't understand the relationships between them. Why did some elements behave similarly? Was there an underlying order? They didn't have the recipe book or the organizing principle.
And that sets the stage for Mendeleev, Dmitri Mendeleev and his periodic table in 1869. This feels like the moment everyone knows.
It's certainly iconic.
Lots of people were trying to organize the elements then, right? Dobereiners, triads, others. What made Mendeleev's attempt so groundbreaking? What was his specific genius?
Well, arranging them by increasing atomic weight was a key step many were trying. But Mendeleev's real genius, his incredible insight, was his confidence in the pattern he saw. He wasn't afraid to leave gaps in his table.
Right. He saw spaces where elements should be, based on the repeating properties, even though nobody had discovered them yet.
Exactly. He trusted the pattern, the underlying law, more than the current list of known elements. He essentially said, nature isn't complete yet, or rather, our knowledge isn't. There must be something here, here, and here.
And that's what Ball calls the scientific prophecy. It wasn't just organizing, it was predicting.
Absolutely predicting. He didn't just leave gaps. He described the properties of the elements that would fill them. Things like their atomic weight, their density, how they'd react. And when elements like gallium and germanium were discovered later,
they matched his predictions
remarkably closely. That predictive power was stunning. It transformed the table from just a useful catalog into this powerful predictive map of matter. It showed there were deep fundamental rules governing the elements.
Okay, so Mendeleev gives us the map, the order, the predictive power. You'd think, story over, we've cracked it. But then science throws another curveball. The atom itself gets questioned.
Right. Just as the chemical definition seemed settled, physics came along and complicated things again. This time, it was radioactivity, discovered by Becquerel and then explored intensely by Marie and Pierre Curie.
How did radioactivity change the definition of an element?
Their work proved that atoms weren't actually immutable, eternal things as Lavoisier's chemical definition implied. Some atoms could spontaneously change. They could decay, transform into atoms of a different element.
Transmutation, the alchemist's dream.
Exactly. But achieved through nuclear processes, physics, not chemistry, an atom of uranium could eventually become lead, for instance. This meant the idea of an element is unbreakable wasn't strictly true at the nuclear level.
So the definition had to evolve again. If it's not about being chemically unbreakable and atomic weight has issues because of isotopes.
Right. Isotopes were another problem for weight-based systems. Atoms of the same element could have different weights because they had different numbers of neutrons. So the definition needed something more fundamental.
And that led to
the modern definition. An element is defined by its atomic number, which we call Z.
Z being the number of protons in the nucleus.
Precisely. The number of protons. That's the unique, unchanging fingerprint of an element.
Why protons specifically? Why is that the key?
Because the number of protons determines the positive charge of the nucleus. And that charge dictates how many electrons the atom holds. And the electron arrangement determines all of its chemical behavior, how it bonds, how it reacts, everything that makes carbon, or oxygen.
So it shifts from an external operational definition, what we can't do to it, to an internal structural one, what it fundamentally is.
Exactly. It's defined by its nuclear charge. That's the most fundamental level we have right now.
But even that story isn't finished, is it? We're still pushing the boundaries.
Oh, definitely. We moved beyond naturally occurring elements long ago. Think about the transuranic elements, everything heavier than uranium on the table.
Synthesized in labs.
Synthesized in particle accelerators, yeah. By smashing atoms together. People like Glenn T. Seaborg were pioneers in creating these new super heavy elements that don't exist naturally on Earth, or maybe only existed for fleeting moments in cosmic events.
And that continues today, looking for even heavier elements.
It does. There's this ongoing quest for what physicists call the theoretical island of stability, a predicted region of super heavy elements that might be surprisingly stable, lasting longer than the fractions of a second many current synthetic elements do. It's really testing the limits of how much nuclear matter can hold together.
Wow. Okay, so that whole historical journey from philosophy to particle physics is fascinating. Now let's connect it back to the bigger picture. Ball paints the cosmic connection.
Yes, this is where it gets really profound, I think. The elements provide this incredible link, this unity between us and the entire universe. Literally every atom inside you, listener, was forged somewhere out there in space.
That famous line, "We are star stuff."
It's not just poetic, it's literal scientific fact. Ball traces the sequence beautifully. First, the Big Bang itself. It created almost exclusively the very lightest elements, hydrogen and helium, and tiny traces of lithium. That's it.
So where did everything else come from? Carbon, oxygen, iron?
Stars. The cores of stars are nuclear furnaces. Under unimaginable pressure and heat, they fuse lighter elements into heavier ones. Hydrogen becomes helium, helium fuses into carbon and oxygen, and so on, up the chain.
Up to iron. I remember reading that iron is kind of a limit in stars.
It is. Fusing elements up to iron releases energy, which powers the star. But fusing iron actually consumes energy, so a star's core fills up with iron, fusion stops, and the star's energy source cuts out.
And then?
For massive stars, gravity wins. The star collapses catastrophically and then explodes in a supernova.
And that's where the heavier stuff comes from. Gold, silver, uranium.
Exactly. That unimaginable violence of the supernova explosion provides the energy needed to forge all the elements heavier than iron. And crucially, the explosion blasts all those elements, light and heavy, out into the galaxy.
Seeding the next generation of stars and planets.
Precisely. Distributing the raw materials needed for rocky planets and ultimately for life.
Ball has a quote about this related to rarity.
Yeah, it's a great one. The rarer an element is, the more it tells us about the violence of the cosmos.
Meaning it takes more extreme conditions to make the really heavy ones.
Exactly. Making gold requires much more violent energetic events than making carbon. So their scarcity reflects the rarity of those extreme cosmic conditions.
Which leads to another really provocative idea you mentioned Ball uses. We are nuclear waste.
Huh. Yeah, it sounds stark, but it's technically true.
Explain that one. How are we waste?
Well, the heavy elements that make up our planet and our bodies, the iron in our blood, calcium in our bones, silicon in rocks, they are the byproducts, the leftovers, from the energy generation processes inside stars and the explosions of supernovae.
So we're made of the ashes of dead stars.
Essentially, yes. Recycled cosmic material expelled billions of years ago that eventually cooled and coalesced to form the Earth and everything on it, including us. It connects our biology directly back to these ancient, violent cosmic events.
That's a pretty mind-blowing connection. So, okay, bringing this all back down to Earth, maybe back to the listener, what are the big takeaways? How does knowing all this change how we see the world right now?
Well, one really important insight Ball emphasizes is this tension between how abundant an element is in the universe versus how significant it is for us, for civilization.
Meaning?
The universe is overwhelmingly hydrogen and helium. Simple, abundant. But the elements that underpin our modern technology, often they're incredibly rare.
Like the rare earth elements you hear about for phones and magnets and stuff.
Exactly those. Things like neodymium for strong magnets or lithium for batteries. They aren't actually that rare in the Earth's crust overall, but they are very difficult to find in concentrated, mineable deposits. And they're chemically very similar, making them hard to separate.
And where they are found is often concentrated geographically, right? Which right. leads to issues.
Big issues. It links this fundamental science directly to resource scarcity, geopolitics, trade disputes, environmental concerns about mining. Our reliance on these scarce elements for everything from smartphones to green energy tech like wind turbines and electric cars makes understanding their chemistry and distribution absolutely critical.
So knowing about elements isn't just academic. It's key to understanding global economics and sustainability challenges.
Absolutely. Ball makes a strong case that basic scientific literacy about elements, where they come from, how much we have, the costs of getting them, is essential for anyone wanting to make informed decisions about environmental policy, recycling, resource management, future technology.
Okay, that's a very practical takeaway. What about on a more personal level? Does this change how you see everyday objects?
Oh, immensely. It adds this layer of cosmic perspective to everything.
Like knowing the iron in your frying pan or even in your blood was forged in a supernova billions of years ago.
Exactly. Or the calcium in your bones came from the core of a dying star. It just transforms the mundane. It gives you this incredible, almost tangible sense of connection to the vastness of space and time. You're not just you. You're this temporary collection of atoms that have been on an unbelievable journey.
Yeah, it stops feeling like just abstract science and becomes part of your own story.
You're a little piece of the universe looking back at itself.
Okay, so reflecting on the whole journey through the book and these ideas, what was the most surprising thing for you, or the biggest shift in perspective?
For me, I think it was really grasping the speed of that change we talked about, from the ancient philosophical elements dominating for millennia to Lavoisier's operational definition, then Mendeleev's pattern, then the nuclear definition, all happening relatively quickly in the grand scheme of things.
It makes you realize our current understanding, even Z, might not be the absolute final word either. Science keeps refining.
Exactly. It highlights that science is a process, always evolving, always building on, or sometimes overturning what came before. Our definitions are powerful, but they're still human constructs trying to grasp reality.
And for you, what's the lasting insight?
I think it's the sheer elegance and power captured in Mendeleev's periodic table. It's more than just a chemistry tool. It really is a concise summary of the building blocks of the entire material universe. And it stands as this amazing testament to human pattern recognition, our ability to find order in complexity. It pulls together physics, chemistry, astronomy, even history and philosophy into one framework. It's just beautiful in a way.
Yeah, it really is. Okay, so as we wrap up, we always like to leave our listeners with a final thought, something provocative to chew on, based on where the science is now.
Right. Thinking about those synthetic elements, the ones we create in labs.
The ones that might only exist for tiny fractions of a second before they decay.
Exactly. So here's the question for you to ponder. If we humans synthesize an element in a particle accelerator, and it only exists for, say, a microsecond, is that element truly part of the natural universe?
Or is it more like an extreme, fleeting artifact of our technology? Does its brief existence tell us more about the fundamental limits of matter, or about the incredible power and perhaps the limits of human ingenuity trying to push those boundaries?
Where does natural end and artificial begin when we're talking about the very building blocks of reality?
Something deep to think about next time you glance at a periodic table, or just look around at the stuff that makes up your world. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world.
This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.